I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
Greenpeace is one of the oldest and most recognized names in environmental advocacy. As a campaign organization, Greenpeace has captured the world with bold displays to protect endangered wildlife and habitats. For decades, they have attempted to hold corporations and governments accountable for damaging nature.
Now Greenpeace is in the process of addressing the relationship between money and environmental protection. In this episode, we have the privilege of speaking with Jorg Riess, director of Greenpeace Europe. We ask him how a campaign to reimagine a sustainable monetary system could fit in with Greenpeace's other actions and what such a campaign would look like.
Here is Jorgo.
So my name is Jorg Riess, and I'm here because I believe that together we can find a way to speed up the transition to a sustainable society. We can speed up the path where we will be living in harmony with nature rather than as a society constantly violating nature and then suffering the consequences. My background is environmentalism and campaigning. So campaigning is about motivating people to act. And I've become motivated to act for the environment really early on. As a child, I was still in primary school. I grew up in West Berlin, and we had very heavy air pollution in those days. It was not the 1970s. And at some point, we were asked not to play outside because the air was so polluted. And so with my friends, we just thought that was outrageous, that we couldn't play because the adults were driving their cars. That's how we saw it. So we did a little demonstration in the street, building sort of fake gas masks out of coffee filters, and then going up and down the street, asking our parents and the adults to stop driving. That was the very first thing I can remember. Later, I got involved with the anti-nuclear movement. We had big actions in Germany in the 1980s, occupying sites to prevent the building of nuclear power plants. And so this is something that I've come to love and to like and to specialize in, you know, how to link up with people and how to motivate people to take action. For the past 20 years, I've been doing this with Greenpeace because I felt that the environmental movement should be stronger in its political impact. And Greenpeace is one of these organizations that has actually a very wide variety of tactics at its disposal and a large range of specialists also. And over the past 20 years, I've been working with my team on many campaigns to advance environmental protection, to try to bring certainly the European society onto a more sustainable path. But it's not just when we work in Brussels, we're not just working on Europe itself, because Europe, the European Union, is the world's biggest trading bloc. And it is, together with the US and China, among the top three economies of the world. So the rules that govern the European market, they have global impact. They have impact on production in Asian countries, on agriculture in South America, because all of these countries want to export to the European Union. So we've, as Greenpeace, we've seen it as a critical place for our global work. If we can improve standards in the European Union, that has knock-on effects elsewhere. We've successfully pushed renewable energy. We've managed to get legislation through in Brussels that made it mandatory for all countries in the EU. And that goes from Sweden in the north, Germany, France, Spain in the south, to go for renewable energies. We've done work to make import of illegal timber in order to address that with legislation. Right now, we're doing again global work where we're exposing how the fires in the Amazon forest, these man-made fires in the Amazon that are destroying the Amazon and that are destroying the livelihoods of the peoples there, how the European Union and its large markets are co-responsible for that. So I could go on.
Yeah, it's such a long history, and Greenpeace is such a powerful image in so many people's minds, even from the 70s. I remember the boats, you know, the guys on the boats chasing the whalers, and I remember people chaining their bodies to the fence in front of the nuclear power plants. And it's such an activist organization. And yet you speak in the beginning about economics and the relationship of economics. And I wonder how that journey has been for you. How did you start with environmentalism and come to this question of its relationship to economics? And even more, a deeper part of that question is, what part of economics do you think is the most important with relationship to the environment?
My interest in monetary systems came really late. I mean, banking and, you know, there was never anything that interested me. I guess like many people who try to protect nature and work for a society that lives more in harmony with nature, you are motivated and touched by what the immediate damage that you see, the polluted river, the forest that gets cut down, the huge fields of monoculture, agriculture full of chemical pesticides, you know, killing all butterflies and birds in the vicinity. That's what motivates you. You're not, and then you go, okay, so who's putting the fertilizers? Why, you know, why are these pesticides being used here? Why are they even allowed? Okay, so, and then you come to the company, and then you come to their lobbies, and then you come to the legislation which permits it. And why? How did this legislation go through? And who voted for it? And what was the greenwash around it, or the propaganda? And you know, what was the real information that needed to be heard, and maybe that wasn't heard, etc. So you sort of unravel it, coming from the point of destruction, coming from the front line of environmental destruction, and you start rolling it back. And for the past 20 years, I've really been, you know, making the bridge from the front line of environmental destruction to the front line of politics, to the front line of legislation for the world's biggest trading bloc and for one of the world's biggest economies, which is the European Union, which rules over laws which then have to be followed in big countries like Germany, France, Spain, Italy, and elsewhere across Europe. Right? So that's how far I took it. And then there is this thing when you stay in environmental campaigning, there are moments when you feel you're like a firefighter, you know, because there's constantly either a new project which is just too stupid to be true, you know, turn this old growth forest into pulp and paper, essentially, or more public money to subsidize our farmers so that they can pass it right on to the agrochemical industry, rather than helping them to transition to a sustainable system that would be healthier for them, producing healthier food for people, and be sustainable in the long run for nature, right? So we were trying to think, so how do we get out of this almost rat race where we're chasing the lobbyists of the dirty industries, trying to expose what they're doing, building momentum, building sufficient political opposition to block that, sometimes winning, often losing, you know, how do you get beyond that? And at the same time, of course, we have the scientific data. We see how rapidly a lot of ecosystems are getting to the brink of collapse. And we see that the destruction is accelerating so much globally. We see that global economic growth, this old school economic theory that we can decouple growth from environmental destruction, that in theory it is possible to have growth without further degrading our natural world. You know, that theory has been around for a while. The data, the facts are, it's not happening. It's not going that way. Even in the most advanced economies, where there has been a certain extent of environmental attention in politics and mainstream politics, even there is only relative decoupling, and environmental destruction is still continuing further.
It always occurs as the incentive structures are misaligned somehow. Like, the economic system gives very strong incentives for companies to push forward and very weak incentives to save the environment or to include the environment as a cost of doing business. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about why that is and why is it okay for a company to destroy the rainforest when they know in 50 years that rainforest will basically destroy their business, you know, when it's gone.
I've seen business from the outside, but I've seen it from quite close, in the sense that I've seen the behavior of their lobbyists and what they really go for, when what legislation they really want, as opposed to what they tell the media or what they tell their customers or what they put in their glossy corporate social responsibility prospectuses. And most businesses, certainly the ones that are listed on the stock markets, have a very short-term perspective where they need to grow. There's almost a growth imperative because they're in a competition with other publicly traded companies and they have certain investors watching out, you know. So there are people breathing down these CEOs' necks. And they want to go for growth. And how does growth work today? You either turn nature into products, you transform the natural world into artifacts that you can sell, or you turn human relationships into services, and thereby you create a market, right? Every time a new piece of this globe and a country that is not yet fully integrated into the global economy goes into the global economy, that's what happens. Their land, their water gets turned into products or production sites, and their human relations start to become monetized and therefore turned into services. So this is just how it works. And this is why I think that appeals to companies to green up. Certainly in Greenpeace, we don't believe that that's the end of the solution. You know, we don't agree. There are different environmental organizations have different approaches. In Greenpeace, we work with companies who we see that they could be a front runner because we want them to be an example so that we can show it's possible. But then the next thing we do is we go to the politicians and we say, this is what's possible. Why do you still allow other companies to be well below that bar? Let's lift up and create a level playing field at a higher level. That's how Greenpeace works with companies. We don't believe that business in itself will come. And it's not because we don't believe in the individual people. We just think that they are within a system that does not allow that. We also work with companies in a different way, in a confrontational way, because that works very well to create stories. I mean, I said, you know, in most of us in Greenpeace, we would like to focus on the more beautiful world that we want to contribute to rather than the problems that we have today. Our experience, though, is that the media focus and listen to us when we criticize what's going wrong today, and they're a bit less interested when we tell them how we think it could be much better in the future. So this is why we work both tactics. We attack the baddies, the companies that currently pollute, and we also promote those who we see that they actually show the way. But that is a limited range.
Yoga, you mentioned, let's go a little bit back. You mentioned in the 80s this big fight against nuclear in West Germany. I think it was mainly West Germany because all the nuclear bases were, I think, in West Germany. It was for me. I was a child, I was 10 years old, and when Chernobyl happened, you know, and I think the Greenpeace had been engaged in this fight against nuclear for a really a long time. And then, boom, Chernobyl. And that was, I mean, you were not allowed maybe in bad air, but all of a sudden I wasn't allowed to go out anymore. You know, I was not allowed to go out to play. But you see, I noticed a massive shift in my parents' conversation. And my dad was a conservative, and he shifted. And they both all of a sudden really, I mean, my mom was always on the side of Greenpeace, but she's like, you know, they've told us, they've warned us, and now it's happening, or it has happened. Like, what kind of shit are we in? And so I was wondering now, when we kind of come now into, from the past to now, right? And we see, as you just described, how much shit is happening. And it's kind of whenever we see a bit of a shift happening, then it kind of gets back. No, it's like almost like keep the system alive. Yeah, like, let's just keep it running because maybe we are not ready yet for something new. And I wonder how you see it or what needs to happen that we could do a shift like it happened with nuclear, or it liked, you mentioned the wall, when the wall was coming down. You know, I think it was an equal consciousness shift where in the beginning in September, nobody thought this wall would come down, and then doof, 2 months later, it was down, right? And so what needs to happen today, in your opinion, that we as a society, or that companies, as we just mentioned, all these examples, do this shift?
My sense is that there is a rapidly growing consciousness that our economic system, and in particular the financial system, are completely at odds with the objectives that we have as society, that they were designed in a different period and for a different era, and they no longer fit. I think people looking back at the 2008 financial crisis, everybody says the banks were saved. Nobody says the people were saved. You know, that's in collective consciousness, I think. We now see massive public spending to, you know, in the context of the COVID pandemic, in the European Union, we have massive spending. It's called recovery and resilience spending. And Greenpeace and others are exposing how much of this is going straight back into the old economy. And all this money, all, you know, this massive public spending is taken on loans on the markets with interests to be paid back by future generations. So it's the wrong type of money to solve the crisis going to the wrong people. And people will again ask more and more questions. I think we're there. I think the system is really breathing its last breaths. At the same time, it's huge. And to many of us, and I, first of all, myself, it seemed it was a system that we didn't really question. To me, the interest in monetary policy came when I started to go beyond asking, where is the money going? Is it going to the right type of industries or the wrong ones? Is it to the right type of public investment, public infrastructure, or the wrong one? But I was sort of thinking, without thinking about it, I was taking money to be neutral. But it could go the right way or the wrong way, and therefore I wanted to motivate politicians to, you know, let it go the right way. Greenpeace wanted to motivate companies to invest it in the right way. We were attacking banks who were investing it in the wrong way. And then I started, you know, when I came, when a former colleague of mine, Jean Le Gourou, introduced me to Bernard Lietat and his book on money and sustainability, The Missing Link, that's when I started to, well, for the first time, realize, hey, there are people who say that money is not neutral, that the money we have has certain effects, that this money that we have is actually not created by the central bank, but is created by the private banks through loans. That to me was complete news. I just thought that's how it is. Money is what you have in your pocket and it comes from the central bank. And the banks lend out what other people put in into the bank. You know, that's the very naive thinking that I had. And, you know, that's sort of what our society, that's sort of what you get to think about it unless you really inquire. And then when I realized it's not like that, our money comes into being through private banks primarily, and it comes into being through loans, and every loan has an interest, which means the money that we have already has interest connected to it, which means the whole system can only work as long as it's growing, because these loans need to be paid back and the banks have an interest to constantly create more money by giving out more loans. The positive effect of this, it enables economic growth. It enables big capital intensive investments. But the negative side of it is that unless this growth is healthy and has no negative effects on society and is sustainable, then the whole system is pumping up the balloon with hot air until it's going to explode. That's what got me interested into monetary policy. And that's what got me interested into thinking, can we go one step further as a campaigning organization, keep exposing and attacking and trying to change where dollars and euros are now going into the old destructive economy rather than into the new society that we want to bring about. You know, we need to keep doing that. And at the same time, that's not enough. I feel we need to go one level beyond. What money do we need for the future? Or rather, what monies do we need for the future? What ecosystem of monies do we need for the future? And there, I think, and this has come across also very well in your previous podcasts, you know, experiences with interest, with negative interest money, etc., can really work in the context of an ecological transition, as well as a, you know, just transition and a more egalitarian transition.
I mean, we talk a lot about the design of money. And I think what the way you just described how money is really created by banks, and the way it's created is by making loans that have interest. And so there's this imperative to grow constantly, combined with this this competitive pressure that basically the people taking out the loans have. So it's a compounded fracture, basically, that you must grow, and for your shareholders and for your banks. And if you don't grow, you die. So you do whatever you can do. And that often means burning down cutting down the rainforest, even though you know it won't be there for all that much longer. And so we're talking about, could we create a system that allows for a robust kind of cycle of life type growth? What would that currency look like, or basket of currencies look like, such that they counterbalance this growth imperative? And, it's a question. It's really just a question. Like, what's the vision from your perspective? Or do you even have a vision about what it would look like?
I would turn your question into an affirmative statement and say yes to it.
Okay, Yorgo. Okay, Yorgo, that's fair. Yeah, no. I mean, I've often wondered if I could design a monetary system that has no imperative for growth, if it would work, because it's not really consistent with self-interest in a certain way.
Firstly, on the design fault of the money that is dominant today, which is bank-generated money that comes into being through debt, and in which we all partake, because that is the money we primarily use, whether it's euro or dollars or yen, they're all made in the same way. The design fault there is indeed that because it comes into being through loans, there is interest connected to it, which brings with it a growth imperative. If you no longer believe that growth can be environmentally neutral or even beneficial, if you take the facts as we have them today, that despite best endeavors in the most advanced countries, growth has negative environmental impact, then you come to the conclusion that money that has growth built into it has a design flaw. And then on the system, on the negative interest rate, this is where, I'm quite keen to connect with more people. And I don't have a ready answer for this. I think we certainly need some monies that have negative interest rate, and they could be employed in certain spheres of society. Because wherever you're trying to achieve an environmental objective, if you're trying to somehow do that by taking out loans with the money that requires you to grow, you're already sort of in contradiction right from the start. And so we see these massive loans being taken out now to refuel the economy. That's the wrong type of money, the wrong type of dollars and euro. We would need a different type of money. Maybe, whether that would be particularly negative interest there or somewhere else, I certainly think that negative interest money is very good to avoid hoarding, to avoid accumulation, to ensure that money actually serves its purpose of, like oil greasing the economy rather than like an instrument of power that gets hoarded somewhere, which often also translate into problematic political power. So we pursue, of course, more than just an environmental objective. We also pursue social equity objectives, and there negative interest money could help this growing inequality that we witness both in Europe and the United States.
Yoga, you're basically pointing to monetary ecosystem. And as I was questioning before, you know, when we compare it to the threat of nuclear to humanity, which was probably in a way, when we compare it to the monetary systems, probably very easy to point out what are the difficulties, what's wrong with the system of nuclear, what's the damage, et cetera, et cetera. And I wonder how we, or you know, how could we, you know, why is it so difficult to point to, why is it not clear to everyone yet, let's put it this way, you know, that something is really wrong. And I agree with you. A lot of people, I think, have been waking up, yeah, including myself. I had no idea how money was created until basically the beginning of my 30s. Yeah, and money wasn't even a question. And why would I? And I was bored with money. Quite frankly, it was just it's not my interest. And all of a sudden you realize, oh, it's so much connected to what you do, what you want to achieve, what to my purpose in life, you know, and then it becomes part of you. And when you look into it, it's actually a really fascinating thing, money itself. If we could use it in the potential it actually offers us, it is fascinating what kind of systems we could create who could serve everyone, you know, not just half of the world and not just the 1%, but really humanity. But I'm just also wondering why it is so difficult to point, and this is what I think Greenpeace has done in the 80s, to really put the finger where it already hurts.
It is difficult to campaign on money. It looks difficult for me to campaign on money, because when I compare it to what we do when we campaign on the destruction of the Amazon and the link to the soy that goes into industrial animal feed, you know, you can show the picture, you can show the Amazon burning, you can show that feed, you can show the huge industrial livestock, these huge farms where these animals are kept in terrible conditions. And people see that, you know, from start to finish, this is something that they don't want to support. In Greenpeace, we would have started campaigning on money already years ago, I think, if it was easier to communicate and also clearer to point to the solution. The communication is really the biggest hurdle, because for a campaigning organization, you need to show the problem in a way that everybody can agree with you that, yes, this is a problem. And so when our Brazilian colleagues go into the Amazon and show, you know, that these fires are man-made and show which companies are behind it, you know, we have video and photo material, we can use that, and then we can track how these goods that are produced on these criminally cleared lands, how they end up in Europe. We put invisible ink on certain tree trunks, and then we show when the boat offloads them, and they say, no, these trees are fine. We show, no, they have the invisible ink on them, they come from there. So you can create the story also visually. This is really where I hope we can contribute, that we will come up with ways to illustrate this. But I think in people's lived experience, the fact that the current system is wrong is not helping us to achieve what we want as a society. I think that many people, that sense of discomfort, and even more the realization that there are solutions and these solutions, they're worth trying out, and they're worth trying out at a much bigger scale. I think that's what many of the complementary currencies have shown. That's what the experiments with basic incomes have shown. You know, this is what we see, what's wrong with shareholder value driven behavior of multinationals. You know, the elements are there. We need to put it together into that kind of story. I hope I can be part of that. And I hope that among your listeners, there are many also to join that. I think it will be a great campaign and a great battle to fight for. And that's, you know, that's the challenge now.
It's so true. Yeah, there is no image to show the vast devastation, what money, the current monetary system, what it actually does to us and our society. And I think there is something, and you will talk about
this. There's no picture. I think that's one of the issues we have. It's invisible. A lot of what we're talking about is invisible to the average person. And I think that's one of the reasons we have this podcast, is to bring that to a visible place. But there's something else I think that's a challenge, and that is when you show the fire is burning and this company burned that fire, an individual knows what they can do. Like, they know as an individual, oh, I can go and lobby against that company, or I can go and, you know, block that tractor. With the monetary system, the solutions are communal. Like, implementing a complementary currency requires a huge amount of organization and thought and systemic thinking. And so I think it's not just the awareness of the problem as much as what it takes to implement a possible solution is not just a simple one person acting. You know, it's coming together. And I think that's what you mentioned in the beginning, is how Greenpeace and your campaigns are about people working together to make that difference. And, you know, we love Greenpeace. We love you for that. So.
What can the individual do on the money system? Can the individual do something? And is that a hurdle? And is that a hurdle that we cannot surmount? You know, I think it's not so different on the environmental issues. Is it a bigger challenge to campaign for a different money system than it is to campaign to protect the Amazon and other pristine forests? Maybe not. Because what you can do as an individual to save the environment today is also very limited. The real solutions are collective solutions. And even when you think of the kind of actions that Greenpeace is doing, few people would put themselves on their own in front of a bulldozer that is clear cutting a forest. You connect with people, you make sure you have sufficient people there. Because on your own, they're going to run you over. Environmentalists are killed every year around the world. So you need to unite to protect the environment against major business interests, in the same way that you need to unite to break through a system that, although it is breaking down, is still tremendously wealthy and powerful and embedded. So I think that the collective action is a requirement for both. And to me, that makes it even more attractive, because it's always better to act together with others. You get support, you get fun. And you can, if you win, you can celebrate together. That's the best thing about it. And as so many of the, you know, the local examples, I spoke to the people early on when they were doing the local currencies in the UK and elsewhere. And I was always asking them, I was saying, hey, I'm in Brussels. Do you think we could do something at the EU level? No. This is best to be done locally. That was their reply. I was always keen to see whether we couldn't sort of accelerate this thing with some good legislation or maybe stop other things that would prove to be a hurdle later on. So communal action is great. And that's why I'm looking forward to do that also on the monetary system. What we need to overcome, we need to find, I think, one or two big objectives, but that many people can rally behind. And then we'll find ways to communicate that. If we hadn't so many fires to put out right now, you know, maybe we would have come already further just with Greenpeace. But I think on this one, we really want to link up with many people, many organizations. And if I can use your podcast or abuse your podcast for a little advertisement, I want to recruit an economist who wants to campaign on this in Brussels this year. So if among your listeners, there is someone who wants to join our team, I'd be really keen to hear from you.
Well, for me, this idea, you know, is quite a wide-reaching conversation. But let's start with how difficult it is to get conscious around the root causes of these problems. You know, it's true. It's like being a fireman who's constantly putting out fires, and you can't really think of anything else when you're putting out fires. And it's the same as that. One of my very favorite metaphors is, you know, people saving babies floating down the river, and pretty soon you have a whole village saving the babies floating down the river, but no one ever has the idea to look upstream to figure out who's throwing the babies into the river, because you're so busy with these
saving babies.
And you know, I think that's actually remarkable that we are finally talking about, oh, this economic system does have an impact on all these things. Maybe we can stop the fires. Maybe we can stop the babies from drowned. And
let's hope. Let's hope there are many, many young economists out there who would love to join Greenpeace and who are interested in finding the source of who's putting the babies into the water. No, I'm serious. You know, and this is the part of a communication. This is part of where what I thought was a very interesting conversation with Jorg, because it is so difficult to communicate what the monetary system does to us. At the same time, he was talking about the burning fires in the Amazon. You know how difficult it actually is to make a fire in the Amazon? And they can only survive because people are there pumping up the fires.
So how is that? The Amazon doesn't just burn?
No, because it is very diverse. It's a diversity of different plants, and not every plant is burning at the same time. When you compare it to a monoculture with only one tree, like these pine forests, right? Mm-hmm. And you have one cigarette, and then, whoa, it blows up. So the burning forest, the monoculture, which is easily being put to fire, versus a intact ecosystem of different plants, which is actually not so easy to put fire on, is for me a perfect example, a perfect metaphor, how the monetary system and the environment is actually one-to-one the same thing. Currently, we live in a monoculture of money, which is basically only the fiat currencies, only the national currencies. And really, at the moment, I know we can talk about this, what is the world currency, but currently, now, February 2021, it is the dollar. So there is no ecosystem of monies, or as Jorgo pointed out, the basket of different currencies for different purposes. We don't have that yet. And then we could have this ecosystem of different monies for different purposes, different goals, and you know, different levels, working at different levels. And that is kind of one-to-one, the metaphor for an ecosystem as we know it in nature.
Mm. So what you're saying is if we had this more diverse set of currencies, we would be much more resilient. We wouldn't have the ups and downs. Would we have a more equal system, or would it address all of these issues that we're talking about?
I think that's a good point. I think this is up to us to decide. This is up to us. What is the purpose of those currencies? Mm-hmm. How do you use them? And at the moment, I think we have this tendency of just cookie cutting the old system into a sort of a more digital era, right? And we could really now take these new technologies and completely redesign the need for a more sustainable economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like when he was talking about negative interest currencies, those currencies lose value over time. And I was actually imagining that what if you had positive interest currencies for capital investments, in other words, they mature over time, and then you had depreciating currencies for operational expenses that are kind of wasting, and so you basically create this, you know, counterbalance, as you called it in the interview, of currencies that are working against each other, but for the general good of everybody. I mean, it seems like very complex to figure out how to design that. That's kind of my question.
Maybe you should apply it in Brussels. I think he has got an opening.
Yeah. Too bad I don't have my doctorate in economics yet.
I don't think you have to have a doctorate. You just need to think economics, live economics, see the goals of Greenpeace, what they want to do.
Anyway, okay.
But I also would like to keep you on the podcast.
So. Jobs aside, it's good to point out that you have discovered communities all over the world developing local currencies to promote local business, local farming, local production. And, you know, that if we keep broadcasting and connecting these communities, eventually, from a bottom up, an economy will grow that is different from the existing economy.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.